Goldberg. I'm a senior policy advisor at the Canadian Human Rights Commission, and it's my great privilege to be chairing this session. This session is called On the Job, Promoting Accessibility, Retention, and Equity. Perhaps in the employment process for the person that's looking for a job, after the process of getting the job, which can be very intimidating for everybody and nerve-wracking, the thing that I suspect a lot of us remember is particularly our first job, the first day on the job, and wondering what the expectations were, how we were going to do, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, employment of people with disabilities, just like the employment of everybody else, is a lot more than just getting the job. It's what you're going to do once you've got the job and what your employer is going to do to ensure that that you do the best possible job you can, because that's in their best interest and your best interest. So we have panelists today who are going to give us different perspectives on how the actual job of doing a job can be enhanced and improved. And I'll just do it in the order that we have it in the program. There's detailed biographies of everybody. I'm not going to take time to go through them. I can tell you all three of these panelists, we had a half-day session yesterday. I heard all of them participate in that, and I can assure you they're all going to be very interesting. We'll start with Suzanne Briere, who's the director of Employment and Disability, the director of the Employment and Disability Institute at Cornell University, and chair of the Global Applied Disability Research and Information Network, GLADNET. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to each of you for joining us this afternoon for this session. I hope we will get a chance to hear your questions and to interact. I was very pleased to have an opportunity to focus on this topic because although I think all of the things we've been talking about, we've certainly spent lots of time at Cornell University looking at disability statistics and national trends and disparities and wages and employment rates. We've also, in the last 20 years, since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, looked at employer practices. The Employment and Disability Institute at Cornell University is seated in the School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and the ILR School is a college of the workplace. And with that backdrop, I have been able to use the resources of my industrial organizational psychologists, organizational development colleagues. We have labor economists. We have collective bargaining experts to begin to complement my own expertise, which is I'm a rehabilitation psychologist and a vocational rehabilitation counselor by background, to look at what happens once you get a job in the world of work. How can we look at, as we were targeted to focus on in the topic today, accessibility, retention, and equity. So to do so, in the brief time I have with you, in response to this topic, I'm going to talk about on-the-job factors only. We're going to look inside the workplace and across workplaces in the brief time we have together. And I'm going to talk about not only what are the things to consider, but what are ways that we are trying to measure those things, to look at what works and doesn't work. And in this brief time, I'm not going to be able to tell you all that we have done in studies, but I'm giving you in that overview what we have used as things we think are important to examine, first of all, parts of the employment process, and secondly, ways we've tried to begin to look at how to measure what that experience is for people with disabilities. And then very briefly, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about that, talk about the implications for workplace policy and practice in a summary about what we're finding. Underneath each of these things are studies we have conducted over the last 20 years, and I'm happy to give you more information about them, but really this is meant to be an overview for me, and I will leave you with a few websites where you can get those resources if you're interested in them. So the first thing I'm going to very briefly talk about, I'm going to talk more about advancement and retention kinds of things and measurement kinds of things on the job, are accessibility and accommodation. And they are appropriately the first item in this presentation this afternoon, this panel that we have this afternoon, because without access, we heard about if you can't get to the job, transportation is really important, and it is, but we aren't going to be focusing on that. But indeed, once you're in that workplace, being able to navigate that workplace is really important. And navigating the workplace has many different facets, so I'm just going to broadly talk about what kinds of things we should be thinking about in accessibility. Most of us think about the physical facility, and indeed that is important. It's important for people to be able to get in to the building where they work, to get to their workstation, to be able to navigate in that work building, to get to restrooms, to get to the cafeteria. So physical access is very important. And as we begin to talk with people with disabilities within workplaces, we have found that it's also important and seldom thought about that employers think as much about physical access between parts of their facilities as within a given building. And we're finding that people find that difficult as well, because then they can't get between buildings for different activities. They don't begin to network with others. They don't find out about other jobs. So physical space, physical facility access is really very important, one consideration. The next is that physical space that the person works within. We find that when we have we've surveyed employers about their information and communications technology and what they know about accessibility, we find that the accommodations they make most often are workstation accommodations, rearranging physical facilities for people so that they'll be accessible. And that's a very important part of accessibility. Is that workstation set up in a way that the person can be maximally effective? And in addition to that, communication technologies. We talk about as a part of workstation, persons being able to have equipment that there may be visual imaging, augmentation, ability to use sound in using their computer, but communication more broadly too. We've heard a little bit, some of our presenters have talked about being able to access online applications. It's a big problem. Employers really aren't there yet. But also intranet, being able to do your online benefits administration, all of those kinds of communications, email that we use all the time, may not be accessible for people with disabilities. Training is often done online, another area of concern. And we're hearing more, and this ties to the bullet, third bullet and the fourth bullet, which is social events and activities, is we're seeing more and more employers allow and, in fact, facilitate social networking. And the plus about that is if people can't get between buildings, they find a way to connect with each other, people of common interests, and find friends from work, outside of work, through social networking activities. Facebook, Twitter, some of these things, however, are not always accessible to people with communication, sensory disabilities. So it's not just physical access for social events and activities, but also communication access and social events and activities that we need to be considering in the workplace, and we do have problems there. Thinking about retention and advancement, there's a number of things to think about. Items such as performance management, effective disability case management, professional development and training, formal and informal mentoring, facilitating on the job opportunities. Some of the things we encourage under performance management is for employers to think about not just waiting once a year, and this is true for any employee. It's always stunning to me when the once a year conversation that a supervisor might have with their employee, it happens all the time. It can be absolutely devastating for a person with disability because the employer may have reservations about performance and not afford that individual an opportunity early enough in that performance evaluation process to give them feedback. So regular and consistent feedback, regular reevaluation of accommodations at the same time is really important. I mentioned effective disability case management because one of the looming concerns often for employers, and it ties into disability, is absence management. And having an effective case management program where people are proactively looking at if we're going to lose people from work, how do we bring them back? How do we provide the supports? Can we do short-term modified work assignments in any way? And effective case management really helps us to provide the supports to the individual to not lose them for longer than necessary to the workplace so that they don't emotionally detach and the supervisor doesn't forget about them. So case management can be a very important tool. Effective professional development and training, formal and informal mentoring, I think they stand for themselves. I would, as to why they're important, I would also mention special assignments and project work, where we often find when we interview people in the workplace that they don't feel they have equitable access to those kinds of things that allow them to show how they can, they have the skills to advance to other levels of jobs that could allow them to expand their opportunities. Another thing we look at is commitment, the culture, climate, and inclusion factors. That means the messages that you get from the top about diversity as a priority. We hear it certainly increasingly about ethnic minorities and women, but we hear it far less about people with disabilities, that global message from the leadership of an organization, which is very important to make something happen differently among your HR professionals, among your supervisors. Identifying advancement opportunity disparities, really looking at those metrics, which I'll talk about in a minute. Being vigilant for not only overt discriminatory behavior, but also for more covert discriminatory micro messages about valuing people. It can be as subtle as in a group of people only looking at people who are non-disabled rather than the person that has a known disability. It can be little, not overt, but very painful for the person, and sends messages to the other team members about who's a valued member of that workforce. Creating opportunities for unit department exposure. And I mentioned facilitating social networking opportunities, not only live in vivo, but also electronic. I'm going to move, because our time is going quickly here, to measures of workplace equity and discrimination. 5 minutes. This is going to be a very fast overview. And the things I'm going to quickly skip through are, here are all the ways you can measure inequity in the workplace that we are working on now. Organizational data, employment discrimination claims, using individual perspectives from HR, supervisors, employees, looking at workplace culture, climate, and inclusion. And I want to also mention disability disclosure considerations, which impact our ability to use lots of these measures. First of all, organizational data. And I'm going to go quickly through each of these, talking about the measures that we can use, their strengths and weaknesses. Organizational data can be metrics on recruitment, hiring, advancement, retention, turnover statistics, exit interviews, grievance data inside the organization, worker compensation claims can be another way of looking at disability data. Its strengths, many more leading edge companies are collecting statistics like this. They have a lot of archived HR data that can show whether discrimination is occurring. The limitations are, yes, there are companies doing it, but not the majority. Many still don't collect data or use data, their diversity data at all, and they may not use disability data, don't collect disability data. So there are limitations in trying to use organizational data, although it can be very useful if you can gain access to it and if they're collecting the right statistics. Employment discrimination claims, they can be inside the organization, if the organization will give it to you, if that business will give you their data. That's sometimes a hard-earned privilege. The strengths are that it can help you identify specific issues. Where in the employment process are there problems? What kinds of disabilities seem to be have persons with which kind of disabilities are having issues? We've been most successful here using our national U.S. employment discrimination charge data and looking at charges not only for disability but how that compares with gender, race, and other kinds of discrimination for other protected populations. Its limitations are that it's all charges filed, and some of them are not meritorious. You have to look and see whether they are. It represents the person's perception of discrimination, which sometimes is not a valid one, so you're looking at perceptions. It doesn't capture disputes that don't arise to the level of grievance. Many, many disputes do get settled inside, or the person chooses not to claim. And we also found, as we looked at these statistics more closely, that there's inconsistencies across where they get the agencies that file the statistics. HR professionals' perspectives. We've looked at this from interviewing individuals, key informants and organizations, across organizations. We've also done it using HR organizations, the Society for Human Resource Management, and we did that 10 years ago, and we just completed a second study as a trying to do a comparison. Thank you. We also had the privilege of doing this in the UK 10 years ago, so we had comparisons across US UK HR perspectives. The strengths, lots of times policies in print don't carry through in the organization, and HR professionals can tell you that what's really happening. It's very helpful to get those perspectives. The associations allow us to compare across companies, which is terrific. Limitations, it's really only a proxy for observations of practice close in. And these policies, although they may look really good, are not always implemented fully or concretely, so we're getting partial views of what's really happening on the ground. And sometimes we just can't get into organizations and interview the key informants. Sometimes that's just too close to home. Similar kinds of problems, I'm going to lump these things now, with both supervisors and employees, getting access to them is difficult. When you can, it's terrific, because they give you a candid view of what that HR policy really tells you, and they are key informants. They impact the person with a disability mightily. I can tell you the supervisor's perception of the person becomes the team member's perception of the person and gives the person the confidence to proceed or not and really go in advance. Similarly, employees' perspectives, we collect data within organizations and we look at perceptions between people with disabilities and not, and find great differences between the perceptions about how satisfied they are, how engaged they are. We get more data like that, those kinds of perceptions, by using workplace culture, climate, and inclusion, either surveys that have been conducted by the company or when we can, we go in and do those kinds of surveys ourselves. Stunning differences in the perceptions of equitable access to opportunities between people with and without disabilities. I want to mention before I close that we are now also looking at why people choose to disclose or not disclose about their disability, because without companies knowing about who they have in their workforce, it's really hard for them to self-assess their efficacy. And we find here are the reasons why people don't disclose: risk of being fired, not hired, concern the employer may focus on their disability, risk of losing health care, fear of limited opportunities. Across the board, concerns if they disclose, if it's not an obvious disability, that will limit their opportunities going forward. Policy and practice implications, I think I've mentioned that as I've gone through, top management commitment, incorporating performance management, attention to across the employment process to these issues. Targeting specific opportunities, developing robust metrics, and attending to climate for inclusion considerations. And we have lots more information on our website. I'd be happy to give you that information. But I am out of time. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. That was a very good overview. And now we'll go on to Joygeet Pal, who's an assistant professor in the School of Information, University of Michigan, and visiting researcher at RCAST at the University of Tokyo. And I think he's going to tell us about accessibility.
Yeah. Thank you for having me here. I'll get straight into this. Basically, my work is on assistive technology, and primarily on assistive technology for people with vision impairments. And what I'm going to talk about is some work we've been doing in India and Peru, and it ties in very closely to the subject of this panel. So first up, I think the reason why this is particularly timely, and a lot of the people who are working with assistive technology related to vision impairment are particularly keen on what happens over the next few years because of certain articles of the CRPD, which suddenly expand the scope of assistive technology in various parts of the world where this was formerly unaffordable. So I'm primarily going to be talking about assistive technologies which are screen reading related. And does anybody have no idea what screen readers are? Okay, so a few people. So basically think of how would you communicate with a computer if you have a vision impairment? There are three basic ways. You could use magnification, you could use or output such as audio or tactile, which could be a braille display. And screen reader is the go-between, if you may, for what happens at the CPU and how it comes out to you. So my thesis here is because of four specific articles. Article 4, to promote R&D of new technology at affordable cost. Article 9, to promote design and production of accessible ICTs. Article 20, for mobility aids and assistive technology. And Article 21, which specifically asks for reasonable accommodation at the workplace. This is an industry which is going to grow dramatically in terms of the number of people who will be covered over the next few years. It will not be a complete coverage at given current costs, but at least there's a pressure to get this going. So what's important about assistive technology, that most of the assistive technology tends to be located, the research tends to be located in a few countries in North America, in some parts of East Asia, and there's a real challenge, there's a number of real challenges for getting assistive technology in the developing world. And I'll talk about how this specifically applies to issues of employment and employability. So there is, along with the talk, also a paper that we are working on, which I'm happy to share with folks, which gives you a good overview of what the assistive technologies are, as well as what is the action related to each of these that might be helpful in understanding more about the subject. And I will share this with anybody who would like to get an access to it. There are three current projects that we are working on, and I'll speak on each of these briefly. One is we're doing a six-country study of CRPD reporting, which started at assistive technology, and then how each of these countries at various levels, so Sweden and Australia at the top end, Tunisia and Peru and Argentina and Guatemala, how each of these are reporting relating to UNCRPD and what this tells us about the growth of assistive technology worldwide. And there are two specific projects relating to screen reading. One is I'll talk a little bit about a survey of screen reader users and how you end up picking what you pick as being your software and how that matters to your employability in an organization. And the second is a study of people who are screen readers and employed in India and Peru. And the objective of that study is primarily to have narratives of people in these workplace situations talking about it themselves. So it's a very qualitative study. It's 1,000 pages of transcripts of basically people talking about their experiences. And there's some amount of statistical work, but as you can imagine, the population itself is very small. And our objective here is to look at people who are in the service sector, and therefore, for lack of better term, serves as a way of public visibility of people with disabilities in sectors which have not traditionally employed them. So our hypothesis here is that there is a fundamental problem with visibility of people with disabilities in certain sectors, and that this study then shows people who are screen reader users who are working at companies pretty much the same functions as anybody else, and that's an important thing to document, which hasn't been being done, especially in the developing world. So, on the screen reading preferences study, essentially, I'm going to oversimplify this, but if you are selecting what technology you're going to use as your primary technology, it is driven by two fundamental factors, as we see in our study. One is, what do you get introduced to first? Okay, you go and you join up at a computer class or whatever is at your school. Whatever you end up doing first often becomes what you end up doing permanently. And there is a big difference between how expert users of screen readers and novice users of screen readers select what technology they prefer. And the biggest difference is on the quality of voice. The reason why this is important is that the natural voice is much more preferred by somebody who is a novice user, whereas an advanced user tends to prefer things like the functionality of the software. The reason why this is important is that when you go from a novice user to an advanced user, you speed up your screen reader. And essentially, what you paid for, meaning the quality of the voice, ends up becoming a more mechanical sounding voice. And the mechanical sounding voice is the one which is the big cost differential between buying a low-end screen reader and a high-end screen reader. This is, I'm oversimplifying it because there's screen reader, there's speech synthesis, but it's a huge topic, so bear with me on this. Okay. And like I said, is that if you want a big paper on this, I'm more than happy to share it with you. Okay. The reason why this is important is that we need to look at two things. One is that both how somebody who selects something is going to get tied to that technology, and the high quality voice technology costs $1,000 a pop. So you can imagine how many people would be willing to pay $1,000 for any piece of software, and then you're tied to that piece of software. Not only are you tied to that piece of software, the company which wants to hire you has to get that piece of software for you because they need to support you at that workplace. Okay. Now, the other factor that comes into mind is what are the switching factors, and of course, economists have done a lot of work into what is your considerations when you want to switch between one tax professional to another, and are there ways of comparing humans' switching behavior from one technology to another to what's happening in this case. What we find is that people who are thinking of switching between, say, Windows and Mac, or Mac and Windows, or Windows and Linux, have a much greater willingness to switch technologies than people who are switching from one screen reader to another. Because there's a sense of complete loss of productivity when I lose that screen reader for a certain period of time. And so there is a lot to be learned about how technology adoption works for assistive technology users who perceive a much greater loss of productivity at the period when they have to do the switch. So all of these are important from the perspectives of how these technologies are both developed by various either government agencies, research agencies, as well as provided to people with disabilities who need these at their workplace. And we say this to take it one step further, that there's very important gender implications of this, because we found in our research that females are a lot less likely to get access to assistive technology through non-state institution sources, which means that if you're female, either you get your first access to assistive technology as a going through school or college, or you're a lot less likely than males to get it at a public place. Reason being that if you have a vision impairment, your family in these countries is a lot less likely to be willing to send you out on your own to a training center to get trained to get to be a technology user and thereafter go on and join the workforce. The policy learning over here is that if you want to serve women with disability, with vision impairments, you need to provide it at institutional sources that people are already enrolled in. Finally, the last point that we make here is that this is a great point for governments to act on Article 4 of the convention, which is to develop low-cost R&D into low-cost assistive technologies. So, I mean, I'm just scratching the surface on what happens on language on assistive technology, on screen readers, like when you're not using English and then you have to use some other language, what happens to that? And that's not even something that we're covering. You can imagine that the entire population that I'm talking about here is the economically highest off population of people with vision impairments, who are not only best off in their countries because a good number of people are not even getting through school, as Javed talked about in the last session, but are also competent in English or Spanish and are therefore a highly educated part of that population. Second part of the study is that on narrative studies of assistive technology and employability. And over here, we've done work on India and Peru right now, and we're continuing to do work on Jordan, and we're hoping to get some work done in Guatemala and Qatar as well, as works with a lot of research. Basically, whatever we get funded to do, we do, and that's a sad fact of this. So, and there are five themes that I will touch on very briefly. that come out of. So essentially, there's we have about 130 interviews which we code, and then there's some part of which is clearly quantifiable about where people are getting access to technology, what kinds of jobs they're doing, and then there are people talking about their apprehensions, their what are they liking or disliking about their work, and these are the things that we've coded into these themes. So the first theme is that there's a great sense of exclusion from the state, which we find very similar in India and Peru, very limited reliance that the state is going to do anything for you. The second thing, which actually a couple of speakers, Barbara earlier today, talked about this idea of channeling, which we've referred to over here as economic engineering. By this, what I mean is that traditionally there's been this thing like people with vision impairments being pushed towards doing massage job or a kind of lottery job, etc. And we are finding this in a very strange way reinventing itself in the technology age, where people are being pushed to do medical transcription jobs. And there are other certain kind of, when you enter into a training course, you don't just get training for a specific technology usage, but you get trained almost directed towards a specific kind of job occupation. Now, this is as you can see it both ways. There are significant consequences for the aspiration of the individual and what they want to do with their work. There are entry barriers, clearly having to do with how people perceive people with disabilities as being able to work in the workflows. The really important two factors that I'd like to talk about, one is that of peer effects, and part of this is difficult to explain without having some of the quotes in front of us, which is that we found a huge number of people, when we talked to them, okay, what do you want to do in as a career? And people would respond with, I want to work in company X, say Cisco or McDonald's. And typically, the studies on aspiration, when you ask somebody what do you want to do, they might refer to a sector or a kind of job function. They don't refer to a specific company. And the reason why this was happening was that there was this huge peer effect of certain companies getting known as friendly, disabled friendly, and that there were people who were working over there. So the entire aspiration of people who were going to the same tech training centers, government-owned, non-government-owned, was being pushed towards not only the sector, but towards companies very specifically. And we found that coming out very strongly, especially in India. The second factor is that of aspiration. Now, the one really important difference between what's happening with assistive technology in the developing world and the developed world, for lack of a better term, is that you tend to get access to this at adulthood. Right, so you don't get so most of the people that we survey or studied did not get access to a screen reader till they were 18, 19. So that means that till that point, many of them were told, "Don't worry, somebody will take care of you." Yada, yada, yada. And suddenly they get to this point where, well, nobody needs to take care of me, and I can do a range of jobs. So the point at which the assistive technology becomes available to the person becomes a huge bump in aspiration for the individual. So these were the key themes that we came across. I also wanted to address some of the, this is my last slide, policy questions and future directions. So the really key point that I've made here is that there's serious investment into assistive technology needed, and there's actually very good technical blueprints that you can come up with where screen reading technology can be improved that won't get improved by standard market forces, but where research at universities might be helpful. And we also make points about the gendered nature of institutional access, which I talked about. The really key point that we wanted to make by doing this study was to do something in which the narratives of the people who are using the technologies and entering the workforces are coming out. That this is not just about coming up with a basic general set of themes, but it's also about creating narratives around the issue. One point which is another big point, which is the mobiles as a key of inclusion, and I'm out of time. So the last point I'll leave you with thinking about here is that the movement of the primary assistive technology device is increasingly going from a desktop to a mobile environment. And there is a lot of thinking to be done about how that is going to impact people's transition into the workforce, especially people who are entering it for the first time. I'll leave you with my email address, and please feel free to contact me, and I will. Thank you.
Thank you for that interesting perspective on technology and employment. And our final panelist is Renique Prinz, who's Research Director and Senior Consultant at ASTRI Research and Consultancy Group and Associate Professor at the University of Applied Sciences in Social Security in the Netherlands. And we're just getting his PowerPoint up.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very honored and pleased to be here. I am a researcher from a small country in northwestern Europe, the Netherlands, and we have a long tradition of fighting with two main problems in Social Security: higher rates of sickness absence and huge numbers of persons on disability benefit. And I already decided when I heard my two speakers before that I have to skip some of my slides, and I will focus with you on the particular issue of job retention, but not being disabled and getting into the job and keeping it, but when you are working and you get health complaints, health restrictions, becoming disabled, what can one do to prevent that you are on the disability benefit rolls? So that is the main topic of my presentation. Myself, I'm a sociologist, a researcher, and we did from our private research institute, we did some studies in this area of what works and what works not. Because we have a tradition of 15 years of attempts, reforms, and now it seems that we managed to get the rates down, but in a quite controversial way maybe, or from your perspective. So I will not concentrate now on Norway and Sweden, which I had also in mind, but there was a poster session in which both countries were already mentioned. So I will focus on what did we learn in the Netherlands and what might be lessons for you and for other countries. You know that the OECD last year brought a report, Breaking the Barriers, and they said Social Security should be activating. It should not only provide benefits, but it should stimulate people to return to the labor market. And it's necessary not only because the costs are high, but there are also technological changes. There are less opportunities for low-skilled workers or workers with health restrictions, so we have to do something proactively. And here you see some rates in most OECD countries, so we talk about high-income countries in this session. Most countries spend only 2% of GDP on sickness and disability benefits, but in the Netherlands, in Norway, Sweden, it was double. And also when you see, look how many people in working age were relying on benefits, in the OECD it was 6%, and in our countries it was double. So we had a problem. We have, of course, the problem you're discussing here, too, about people to get into employment, but we had also a problem in when they are in employment and we report sick and it takes on and on and on, what can we do to prevent that they leave the labor market, that they leave the working process? Here you see one of the statistics the OECD made, and the two largest columns there on the left are Finland and the Netherlands. That's in the dates from 1980. The dots, the blue dots, are from 2007, and you see in most countries it has been growing, but in Finland and the Netherlands it went down. And so I'm going to concentrate. Portugal it went down too, but I didn't include it in my study, but I will focus on the Netherlands. This we forget. What is the focus of the reforms in our countries, in northwestern Europe, when we're dealing with these issues? There are two aims: reduction of public expenditures and keep more persons in employment, because these also are countries with labor market deficits. We have low unemployment rates, so also from a labor market perspective, we need everybody on the labor market. We already know that in 5 years we need 5,000 teachers in high school. And in healthcare, there already are many vacancies. So there's also another reason to get people into employment. People also who from categories like disabled or ethnic minorities who in the past didn't get a chance maybe. Now we think, and that's why the mindset of our employers changed too, they are forced to employ persons with disabilities because other people are not those where they recruited from in the past. That group is getting smaller and smaller. So what type of measures do you find when you are dealing in a country with high rates of sickness and disability that you have one important principle is early intervention, and I'll show you later in a very pragmatic way what this means. It is also a lesson to increase responsibilities of employer and employee, and not of the doctor, but of the employer and employee, because what we need is demedicalization, not focus on what people cannot do, but focus on what they still can do. And we need to spend attention to employment of older workers. We know disability grows when you get all the chance of disability, so we have to focus too on older workers. So Norway, I forget now, you will see it in the slides later on, and then we go to the Netherlands. What does it mean, early intervention? It means change of responsibilities and incentives. Namely, the employer and employee should get more tasks to get back to work. And it also means that Social Security, which was always in the past supporting, gets a reduced role. And also in our country, private providers, service providers, got more chances. What were the outcomes of these reforms? And I'll show you later what we did. That sickness absence went down from 5.3 to 4.2%, and the disability inflow, which was yearly 90 or 100,000, went down to 40,000. But also, we have to acknowledge that in young people leaving the workforce due to disability, it's still growing. That category we don't know how to deal with. What happens in our country that we say, how can we reduce sickness absence and prevent disability? That means that employer and employee have to work together and that the doctor should be on distance. So what happens, and I show it you in two slides very pragmatically, if you report sick in the Netherlands, you report sick with the employer, and after 6 weeks, the occupational physician, which is compulsory in our country, makes a problem analysis. And you know that most cases have recovered within 6 weeks, 80% recovers within 2 weeks. So after 6 weeks, if there's still a case which might become serious, the occupational physician should make an analysis. But now, most important, in the 8th week, the worker who is sick and his supervisor or employer should sit together on the table and make a return to work plan, just to see how can I get you back to work with adaptation of working time or tasks or temporary tasks. And that is one of the elements which now is introduced now in Sweden and in Norway, for instance. Just give the responsibility back to those who are responsible in the work situation, employer and employee. They have to try to solve the problem. And when the person does not get back to work, every 6 or 8 weeks, there should be contact between employer and employee. And after almost 1 year, the employer informs Social Security, we might have a problem because the person still cannot come back to work. But it's, hopla, I wanted to go up. That was the wrong. Yes. So after 1 year, it's not over. They still have to continue to work together, employer and employee. Because in the 12th month, and of course realize that this is only in rare cases, but employer and employee evaluate. What did we do to get the person back to work? What could we do, or should we look for a job somewhere else? After 21 months, they make a report, and then the client wants to claim disability benefit after 2 years. And you should realize that in this period, the employer pays the wage. The first year, 100%, the second year, 70%. Why is this? Just to give employers an incentive to stimulate them to do something. And not to say it's Social Security which pays. No, let the employer feel it in his wallet when somebody is sick that he or she has to become active him or herself too. So after 23 months, and this is of course a very small number of cases, Social Security gets a claim for a disability benefit, but then Social Security says, before we start processing the claim, we check whether employer and employee did enough in the past 2 years to get the person back to work. And if it shows that the employer didn't do enough because he wants to get rid of the person, and in our countries it's difficult to dismiss people with, who are sick, if it shows that the employer didn't do his utmost, then they may he maybe get the penalty to pay some extra months of wage. But for me as a worker, there are obligations too. I got more responsibilities. If I get sick, say I break a leg and my employer says, well, Mr. Prince, in your type of work, we order that a taxi picks you up in the morning and you work 4 hours a day, I cannot refuse. If the occupational physician also agrees with my type of work. So if I would refuse, then the employer is allowed to stop paying my wage. So there is an incentive for the worker too and for the employer. What are the evaluations? I already showed you that the data went down. Employers became more aware of costs of sickness and disability, and they got more interest in personnel policy, working conditions policy, disability policies. This is all based on surveys in workers, in employers, in doctors. Employees had to learn a lot too. Yes, that they became more aware that they have to be active in recovery and in work resumption. And that they have to, that they became aware that after 1 year, the wage goes down by 30%. And that they had to accept part-time work resumption or temporary adaptations of jobs. So, what was the impact of these measures? Positive, much more persons with reduced health stayed in employment. And there was prevention that they had to rely on disability benefits. On the other side, this system does not work for job seekers with disabilities because it's focused totally on those who have a job and get health complaints. So, what are the challenges for the coming time now that we have to face this is a solution, but there are more people now coming to in the labor market where vitality and workability is relevant, that we have to be aware that our working population is aging. We have other point we have to realize that the number of persons with chronic diseases is rising in the population too. We also have to find out, should the employer give advice or of course the employer should give workplace health promotion, but should the employer also give private health promotion about my obesity or about my drinking behavior or about, so these are discussions too. How far should employer involvement go? And finally, as I indicated, that in the trends it is rising that young persons with disability, also with mental health problems or the autistic spectrum problems, is rising in our country and in more West European countries. Employees with mental health problems, it's the main reason now, mental health for going into disability pensions. And a category which we ignored in the past is that we always think from somebody is unemployed or has a disability or is sick. But we found out in a recent study in the Netherlands that from those who are receiving benefits, about 40% has also what we call multiple problems. They may have problems with drug addiction or with mental health problems or with unemployment. They are unemployed or they have no job. Health problems. Debts is an important issue. So there are some categories where we are not aware that disability or sickness is combined with other problems too. And the point is there, who takes the role, the lead to deal with these types of problems. So we are not ready yet, but in the way how to reduce the number of persons going into disability benefits and to keep them in the workforce, there we think by giving more responsibility to employer and to employee that we had quite some success. And this model was supported by government, labor unions, and employers, because employers too said, well, okay, we don't like that we have to pay, maybe for a year, but they can reinsure it privately, but they also were happy that they got tools to affect sickness and disability, and that they were no longer relying on what does the doctor say? Is there a certificate? When do you think the doctor can say that you can go back to work? There are tools for the employer and to affect sickness and prevent disability, and this needs a culture change too, also in this area. The worker has to learn that you should combine recovery and work resumption. In the past we thought you only can go back to work when you are 100% recovered. Now we know work resumption is good for your health. Even if you are not fully recovered, but going back to work, getting the rhythm again is good. And that also for employers to become flexible and say, well, okay, if I adapt jobs or tasks, then I can get the person already back to work. And when you have a labor market with low unemployment, you are happy that the worker goes back to work. This whole thinking about shifting the roles of doctors, employers, employees, it took 10 till 15 years. Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 10 minutes for questions and our comments. So if anybody would like to ask a question or make a comment, there is a microphone here.
This is a question for Suzanne. When you were speaking about increasing social networking opportunities for individuals with disability within employer settings, what I'm seeing now are two separate models, and one are employee resource groups for all employees versus employee resource groups that are specifically for disabled people. And I wonder if you could comment on some of the pros and cons of these two models.
We hear lots more conversation about what were called a couple years ago affinity groups and now are called either employee or network resource groups. And more recently, we hear them called business resource groups because the model has evolved in a very short time from being a social networking focus to now more, I think, people felt that they wanted to be able to both companies and people felt that they wanted to contribute to the organization more. So we see them being used differently. I think they're very useful. I think the positive thing about them is that it's an articulation from the top that disability is an important focus. So I like to see them included. They're being done for other groups. I like to see disability also on the agenda. I think the downside is that it can be nothing more than just a socialization. And I think although there's many positive reasons to get people together so that they can talk about common interests and concerns and perhaps have a voice at the workplace, I think it's important that it's also used as a way to advance opportunity. So it needs to be more than that. The more successful ones I see are ones that are not just for people with disabilities, but for their allies, so that people who are caregivers, people who are parents, and people who are just concerned about these issues join. And that helps also in that it takes away the stigma that is still there around self-identification, because some people choose not to join groups like disability groups. It's also true for the LGBT group because they're concerned about self-identification. So when you broaden the agenda to include allies, you help to lessen the likelihood that that could be an impediment for people joining. So I think they're good. I think they're useful. I think how you craft them is really important to maximize the utility.
Hi, question for Dr. Powell. How do you feel about open source stuff like NVDA along with YouTube and other self-teaching tools? I just checked on my mobile and it says NVDA is available in Hindi.
Yeah, so actually the whole when I said that the low-cost one would be cheaper, and I was talking specifically about NVDA, which is it's a free screen reader which any of you can actually just download and start playing with if you want. But it has a limited number of large corpus text-to-speech available right now, and that's the problem. So the fact that it's available in a new language, is in a different language, there's issues firstly with how broadly it's available in that language. So Hindi and Indian languages are very easy because they're phonetically spelled. Right, so you cannot read it two different ways if it is written in a certain way. But Arabic, for instance, it's the diacritization is not there when it's written. As a result, you cannot read it unless you know the context of what's happening around the words. So there are still some issues with high quality NVDA, but I definitely expect in the next few years NVDA is going to grow. And WebAIM surveys, which is the biggest survey on screen readers, has shown that NVDA has been growing every year, and now a quarter of the persons who have screen readers have NVDA installed on their machines. That doesn't mean that that's the one that they are primarily using.
Yeah, I think this, I just wanted to add a few things to what Suzanne did say. I think she mentioned about self-identification. I think whilst we're trying to educate employers about the potentials of the, especially in my case with the visually impaired, I sometimes have the tendency of not disclosing my disability, especially when I'm being invited for an interview. Sometimes the potential employer might put you off when you say you have a vision impairment, you know. So that is what I don't do that. I don't disclose it. And then when I have the opportunity to meet them, at that moment I have the chance to at least show them what I'm able to do with the technology that I have. And I have two instances when I was going to do my field placement for my BSW. I went there for an interview, and as soon as I got there, I think they were wondering how I was going to do the job, because they have never come into contact with, worked with anybody who had a vision impairment. So I got out my computer, I told them how I was going to do the job. If it meant filling up forms, what I was going to do was get the forms scanned in into my computer, and I can fill them out and print them out. And they even saw that it was even better looking than what they were filling in with their pens and pencils. You know. So in my case sometimes, and it's similarly when I was going in for my stage placement again for my MSW, it was the same thing. And when they finally employed me, my supervisor said, "Richie, did you know when you first came, we were wondering how we were going to work with you. But after our meeting with you, we felt relieved, you know." So sometimes maybe people don't disclose because of some of these things. And that is what I wanted to add to this.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah.
And with our technology, man, I think in case of Africa, it would be very nice if the cost of these things come to a very low minimum for us to afford them.
Yeah, actually, one thing I can add very quickly for in several countries in Africa, the NVDA and free technology actually hold a good promise, because a lot of them, for the written form, use the Roman alphabet. And so it's easier to build screen reading technology for such situations. However, we did do some work in West Africa, and it was really difficult in terms of the existing institutional development. We did some work in Sierra Leone, and there was very little training available for people who wanted to learn how to use a screen reader. So
yeah, I think I would like to get in touch with you later on.
Sure. I think Barbara Murray had her hand up. Barbara?
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Prince. Thank you very much for a fascinating overview of what's happened lately in the Netherlands. Could you say a bit more about how employers were convinced to buy into this new law? Because it seems as if their role,
yes,
you know...
Of course, our employers are as your employers are, as in most countries are, but this is what they got was a combination which had for them attractive sides and also for the labor unions. For instance, the employers had no longer to pay social security contributions due for sickness because they paid it themselves. So in the past there was a rate, a contribution rate for employers for sickness benefits, not for healthcare costs, but sickness benefits. So now they know they had to pay themselves, so they could affect. You know, most of those costs are produced by long-term cases. Now they could do something themselves to affect it. And they saw, if I do something on working conditions, if I communicate with the worker, and if I use my occupational physician to be involved in this, then I see I can reduce sickness absence. When this started, in the first year, the sickness absence dropped by 20%. Just because employers in the past said, well, it's Social Security which pays for sickness benefits, so we don't bother, it's a matter for doctors. And now they learned that they can have to do something, but they can affect it. So employers are they are aware that in this sense they have lower costs, and they can have influence the phenomenon themselves. If they have lower inflow in disability scheme, their contributions for the disability schemes are lower too. So there is a financial incentive for the employer to affect this and not to rely fully on what the medical professionals are saying. So that was the main reason for employers to say, all in all, because they also had to accept that pre-employment examinations are forbidden, because we didn't want that the employer, since they have to pay more, that they could say, well, let me test you, screen you thoroughly, and if you have something in your health, then we don't accept. No, this has been forbidden except for airplane pilots and bus drivers, etc. And for labor unions, it was attractive because now we got compulsory occupational health care all over the country. So they had to accept that the benefits went lower in the second year, only 70% of the last wage. But so for them, there were attractive sides too. So this took a process of 10 years, or now seven, and rethinking. And there was opposition, especially from doctors, who thought that we are losing some of our areas where we are the experts. We know whether somebody can work. Well, the family doctor doesn't know whether somebody can work. What do they know about work? So you can better have a supportive role for the occupational physician than for the family doctor. Although most countries say you need a certificate from the family doctor. But we don't do it anymore.
Okay, I think we have time for perhaps one more question and a quick answer. Or if not, I'd like to thank the panelists very much.
This is a question still for you, sir. Would this not be a disincentive to hire an employee with a health issue, a health-related disability, where I know that I may have to pay this employee a year from now, a year's worth of salary?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the fears we had in the beginning, and we saw that the first years the employers were very active to keep those with health restrictions in the workforce. And that's what you saw, that the line inflow into disability went down. Now there is still a need for personnel. We have low unemployment rates. So now employers are more and more forced. It's not only ethical. I don't believe that employers only from an ethical perspective employ persons with disabilities, but they are forced in certain sectors, healthcare, hotels, the grocery shops, etc., to accept for certain jobs people which have disabilities. And we see that their employment is slowly increasing because employers are forced now to recruit from subgroups, ethnic minorities, and persons with disabilities, where in the past they wouldn't recruit from. So they first made their staff complete by keeping people which in the past they lost to keep them in the workforce. They are now in a more force to keep them in the workforce because there's not enough people to recruit. And now they start to recruit also persons with disabilities. So it's slowly rising, very slowly.
Great. Thank you very much, everyone. We have one announcement.
Just to let you know, as you know, as you know, it's break time. It's actually